so good to see everyone here this evening, to look out in the audience and see faces that I have just learned to get acquainted with this week from the congregation here. And then I look in the audience and see some that I haven't seen for nearly 50 years. So that's been a long time. It's always good in holding gospel meetings from time to time to go to places and brethren come and visit and you get to see them and see them when you haven't seen them in a long time. And it's encouraging to talk over things about spiritual values especially, but to talk over things of our past and reminisce a little bit and act about a little bit silly sometimes when we get to thinking about what all we did in our past. So grateful for everyone here this evening. The scriptures teach that, there it is, I lost my button here. The scriptures teach that our eyes are windows to our heart. When we look in Matthew chapter 6 and verses 22 through 23, Matthew wrote, "The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Therefore, if the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" When he talks about the eyes here, he's talking about not just the visual eyes, but that which can let things into our hearts. And so we're talking about that which is seen, that which may be heard, that which is touched. For example, a deaf person can see and get a message in. But a blind person may not be able to see, but they can still get into their heart something by hearing. Or someone who is deaf and blind, they can do it by touch. They can by braille or perhaps communicate in that way. In Job chapter 31 in verses 7 through 8, Job combines the idea of the heart and the eyes and the conduct of an individual when he said, "If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out." This lesson this evening is intended to help us to resolve to keep our hearts pure. Keep our hearts pure and to turn from the things of this world that are all around us to tempt us to draw our hearts away from God and draw them into impurity. We're going to be talking about things that have to do with the immorality of this world and how we can better establish our morality. This is a subject that is needed. It is a subject we need to speak on a lot. Immorality becomes the standard of our society today and is the standard for so many people that it becomes normal, and that normal then, of course, becomes comfortable with everyone. And as Christians, ignoring it or maybe going into denial or being dishonest about this particular thing is not going to make it go away. We can be embarrassed to talk about some of the things that are dealing with immorality in our society. That's not going to make it go away. We're going to have to do something to combat those things that are around us that want to cause our hearts to go astray. The devil will take advantage of our cowardice, will take advantage of our indifference, our dishonesty, or maybe going into denial. He'll take advantage of that and push it as far as he can to get as many people to follow him as he possibly can. Let's begin by thinking about or talking about the source of immoral thoughts. Immoral thoughts come from immoral sources. We see it in our everyday life if we work out in the public and are around people, the kids in school a lot of times. We'll hear things of a vulgar nature, maybe vulgar talk or jokes or conversations that are intended to be lighthearted and to try to draw attention, and yet the thoughts are thoughts that cause others to think evil thoughts. We find it in that source. One big problem we're seeing in our society today, especially in the age of the digital or the internet connections that we have, is pornography. The word pornography comes from two words, porne, which means a prostitute. That is a person who would give themselves to someone else for sexual favor or maybe do it for pay as well. And then the last part of that word, graphe or graphein, which is the word we would find in the Greek, means to write. So you've got this idea of things written about things that are immoral. It is related to, as you look closely to it, the word fornication is akin to that. So we're talking about writings or pictures or images of shameful human nakedness in the mind. It's something that puts those images in the minds and therefore in the heart of the individual. And it primarily is designed to exploit and degrade women. Although it's not exclusive to that, it degrades women and causes men to want to lust after them. But it can include also, and our society has now made it coming out into the open, homosexual relationships, men with men, women with women. It includes a lot of things as far as the visual attack of the eye, letting things into the heart. It includes the visual and the audible means of communication. For example, TV. Even in comedy, even in cartoon-type comedy shows that are now showing on TV, they're going to try to bring in immoral ideas and attitudes and concepts about human immorality and make light of it. And it seems innocent because, after all, it's just a cartoon. It's not going to hurt anybody. And kids can be drawn into that and drawn into the messages that are associated with those cartoons, as they are called. Movies, magazines, there's clothing advertisements that are constantly bombarding the ads that are found on TV programs. We look at the books that are on the shelves in some libraries, or rather some bookstores that are selling books, music, lyrics, the internet, just on and on. We can see all around us are the evidence of sources where our eyes, if we're not careful, can let into our heart thoughts we should not have of an immoral nature. Even things like so-called art, things that have been revered throughout, well, centuries, called art, that depict the human nakedness, that has the power to stir thinking. And people will say, this is art, but this is art, or make excuses, this is only art, this is sculpture, this is painting. Even in modern times, this is photography, and it is a form of art, and try to put it into a soft situation where it's okay to have that. But you know, when you rename pornography, it doesn't change it. It's still the same. It's still that which will stir the heart to think wrong thoughts or immoral thoughts. And another area associated with that is indecent or immodest attire and conduct in the lives of people today. God has created man with a special desire. And it's a desire that is to only be shared in a marriage relationship between a man and a woman. And it is to be shared only there and not outside of that. Now, I'm going to say man and a woman. I could spend another sermon talking about what people are saying is a marriage relationship. But I don't want to waste my time on that tonight. We're just going to go from the standpoint of man and woman being married. But that is what the Lord has taught in Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. The expression bed here is an expression that describes that sexual interaction. But it is an interaction that is basically the same both in marriage and outside of marriage, which is described as adultery or fornication. In other words, what we're looking at here is that man is made with a certain desire. How is he going to use that desire? One is right, one is wrong. When we look at a comparison of the use of this idea of one flesh, back in the very beginning when man was created, in Genesis 2:24, therefore man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The most beautiful description of a man and woman coming together to establish themselves together, to establish a home, and to enjoy their lifelong companionship. That same expression is used also in 1 Corinthians chapter 6:13 and verses 15 through 16. And the scripture says, now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. So you've got an action here that God has given man to enjoy, or he has created man for that purpose, but it can also be used in the wrong way. We'll see that as we get further into the lesson. Physiologically and psychologically, the sexual desires between men and women are different. They are different. There's all kinds of documentations if you want to know that about the difference between how man desires and woman desires in that relationship, that physical relationship. But it does not mean that one doesn't have desire and the other one does. We turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verses 1 through 7. And if you care to read through that, you can, but it describes here the desire of the husband for the wife and the wife for the husband. So the relationship is one that calls upon them to both be responsible for their hearts and their attitudes in that relationship, and in regard to an immoral use of that relationship outside of marriage. So both men and women, boys and girls, are accountable in this matter of immorality. It's not just a man thing. It's not just a woman thing, but both have a responsibility. However, as we observe, the greatest social issues in our society are centered more around how a man looks at a woman than how a woman looks at a man. And what do I mean by that? Well, consider this. The focus of pornography is primarily on women to attract a man, and man is behind the desire for that more so than women toward men. Now, that's the focus of it. I'm not saying it's exclusive, but that is the focus of it, since it's that way. Crimes of sexual assault are more toward men, how they treat women, more so than how women abuse men. Does it happen the other way? Yes, it does, but more so. You go to the Bible and look at the examples of those who were involved in corrupt relationships, and it was a man and how he treated a woman, more so than how the woman treated the man. And it changed the society they were in as you go through both Old and in the New Testament. And the crimes that we see, just all in any direction you go. I think we doesn't take much time, much to understand that that relationship is more about how a man looks at a woman than how a woman looks at a man. Men and women, boys and girls, true manhood and true womanhood is demonstrated by showing godly character, not by showing flesh, not by showing the body. Our character carries more weight and more value to ourselves, to our mates, to those around us, to society, to the church, than showing off our bodies. And so we need to keep that in mind if we're going to serve God. But why are impure sexual thoughts and actions so sinful? They've always had a very powerful, damaging effect if it was abused in the Old Testament or in biblical context or in our day and time, even today. Well, stop and think about it for just a moment. The greater the value of something, the greater is the crime and then the punishment for that. There's a world of difference in the punishment of one who has murdered someone than one who's stolen a candy bar from the local convenience store, because the value of what is being abused is greater in murder than it is a candy bar. So you've got this emphasis that God has on something that is extremely valuable. The marriage relationship and the sexual relationship in marriage is extremely of high value in the eyes of God. It has great power in that marriage relationship. It is something that God intended for it to be strong and powerful. And to violate it means that there is greater punishment, greater consequences that are created because of that. And that's what makes the sexual corruption in marriage so sinful when marriage is violated that way. God designed the relationship, sexual relationship, to have a powerfully addictive quality about it. Powerfully addictive property about it. As we look at that and think about it, we think that this is the case, as we see in our society, the power of the sexual relationships that create immorality. But he created it for the right reason. And that is the good relationship that one can enjoy. And so in the good way, aside from the fact that that strength that would draw two people together to propagate the human race, there is that which would draw a man and a woman together because of that connecting, addictive quality, always bringing them back together so that they can strengthen their relationship in marriage. There is power in that. But that power doesn't just go away if somebody's not married. It's also among those who aren't married. And so here you begin to consider, how am I going to control or watch out for abusing that power? That addictive quality doesn't change just because someone is married. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, we have the reason for that warning of the marriage relationship being the place where that power is enjoyed, because taking that power outside would be wrong. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This is a good thing. The very idea of its power drawing two people together is a good thing, and God wanted it that way. He intended for it to be that way. But then you take it outside of the marriage relationship, and the power still remains there, but that power will cause a person to destroy their lives, destroy relationships. Outside, it would cause one to repeatedly look at or to think about or to engage in sexual misconduct. And then, of course, going from that point, it would cause them to begin to lie then, and to sneak around, and to deceive others, and to be drawn further and further into sexual misconduct than that he or she intended to go. The nature of pornography just takes advantage of that power, that property that God intended to be drawn strong and be strong in marriage relationship. It has the power to draw someone deeply into corruption in their lives. So the power's there. God had made it that way, but God had regulated it as well. Look at Matthew chapter 5 and verses 27 through 28. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So you have that power of not just the committing of adultery, but looking at it. And that looking at it and planting the seed in the heart, then it can have power to draw even further into action rather than thoughts only. In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verses 12 through 14, in that passage, it makes the statement about the power of sin. It says they had eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, as if they are drawn into it, and now it is just drawing them further into it. They cannot cease from sin, as it would describe an addiction. Young or old, married or not, don't deny yourself of that special power and treasure that God has given to those in a marriage relationship. Whether you're married or not, you still respect that marriage and respect where that power is to be placed and to be enjoyed. Respect and love your mate enough to protect that treasure as well. Fight for that relationship. Today, relationships, many of them are called open. And any and everybody can share in that as they come and go. And that's the nature of our society and society's thinking. It's okay. It's okay. It's normal. It trickles down into our children's psyche and their thinking processes. And that's a dangerous thing. So we need to, as Christians, be on guard about that. There are some key factors to consider here, or a key factor that promotes the sexual immorality. It's the mental portrayal of the nakedness of others. Now, if you took that out of the picture, the issue goes away. And so here is the image that creates all that we're talking about in the various directions we go with the corruption in morals. It has to do with the image of the image of nakedness in the mind of the human, nakedness exposed. Therefore, the covering of that nakedness becomes a major part of keeping morals intact. This requires an understanding of what modest conduct is and modest apparel is and modesty is when it comes to those things that pertain to morality. There are two ways that we have a two-way responsibility in this matter. I can only control my eyes. And you control how you dress. Vice versa, I control how I dress and you control your eyes. And so we have a two-way responsibility toward each other. I can't tell you how to dress or dress you. I can only control my eyes. But you have a responsibility toward me and my eyes, and I towards you. So there is a responsibility as Christians, especially in the world, it doesn't seem to matter, but as Christians, if we're going to be godly, we need to recognize that two-way responsibility. There are two keys in understanding what God teaches on modest apparel and modest conduct. Two things to consider. The first one is this, that nakedness is shared mentally and physically in the marriage relationship. We're looking at how God sees it. That's where it is shared. The second thing is to determine what would be shameful nakedness, that is to expose it and become shamed, and then cover it. If you're going to buy a tarp for your boat, what do you do first? You find out what you need to cover. Then you go find a tarp to cover it. Well, think of it that way. When we can learn what God would call shameful if exposed, then we find out how to cover it. We do what it takes to cover what God says needs to be covered. And so therefore, the subject of modest apparel becomes directly related to the marriage relationship, because it is related to preserving something for that relationship, where only in that relationship can the sharing of that exposure or that nakedness is allowed. Otherwise, it needs to be covered, and so we need to understand what that means. If we don't get any point out of this lesson besides this one, get this one. Modesty is not an old fogey preacher's wanting to harass the young people's clothing styles. Modesty is a marriage issue. It's a marriage issue, whether you're married or not. All things related to that part of humanity where they share together in something that much of a treasure is a marriage issue. And covering that treasure, modesty is a part of a marriage issue. Well, keep that in mind, and I'd probably stop at that point now if you promise that you got that point. But we're going to go on and look at details. I find this, that sometimes people that are a little bit leery about a subject like this, they're going to want to listen to a preacher, and they're going to want to fine cut every word he says. Well, he said this about clothing, and my clothes are not quite like that, so I'm okay. And they won't be honest with the point and the principle behind what we're talking about. So don't be that way. I hope you're not that way tonight. We may have to go into some details here, or we will go into details that will help us see clearly what God wants. Can we know what is modest? Can we know? I believe we can. Some would say, well, there is no line, and God did not draw any kind of line for modesty. Are they sure about that? Are they sure about that? Assert that there is no line, there is no way God can define it. Are they sure about that? That's a pretty bold statement. Well, you cannot use the Old Testament because we're not under the old law. Are we dealing with an old law, new law issue here? Or are we dealing with something else? Godly men and women will just know what is modest. But if they know, then they can tell you where the line is. And if there is no line, I just blanked this out here. Here we go. If there is no line, then how can they know? Well, they just know. How do they know? That's ambiguous. But, well, stop and think about it. Would God give mankind such a powerful thing that can, out of the right context, be used to destroy so many lives without giving specific details about how to control it and protect it and follow it properly? I don't think so. I think he would give us very good details that we could understand and learn. In Leviticus chapter 18 and chapter 18 and 20, and we're not going to go over there and read that, but you can read it sometime on your own, because I'm referring to just two chapters here, so we're not going to read two chapters.